you can claim the life you were meant to have. This is All the Way In Radio. I'm your host, Deborah E. Lake, and I'm here to help you recognize, claim, and live fully in your life. It's easy to find people who will tell you you can't, but success and happiness only come when we reject you can't and fully embrace I can. The philosophical foundation for All the Way In can be summed up in the advice of my father, who told me to let the words of my critics roll away like water from a duck's back. So clear your mind and open your heart. Enjoy. You'll be glad you did. Welcome to the special edition of All the Way In. I'm your host, Deborah E. Lake, and I'm glad you're with us. Today's Tuesday, November the 24th. And like I said earlier, just a few minutes ago, that this is a special edition of All the Way In, because the recent events at Fort Hood, where 13 people were killed and 30 others wounded, and some of the discussions that I have read and heard since this has moved me to invite several people who represent different faith traditions. And we're going to explore some of the issues that have been raised and bring a new light, I hope. So without any further ado, I will start to bring in our panelists and have them introduce themselves, and we'll start the conversation. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello, Deborah.
Hi.
This is John Backman.
Hi, how are you? Welcome to All the Way In.
Thank you.
And we are going to bring the other two. We have two other people joining us as well. Hold on one sec. Hello, you're on the air. This is All the Way In.
Hello, hello, Deborah. This is Dr. Frank Romano from Jerusalem.
Hi, I'm glad you're here. We've got one more person to bring in. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Margaret Klein.
Hi. Hi, welcome everyone. Can you all hear me and everything?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, great. So
yes.
We are going to have a discussion. And one of the things I'd like to do, I'm not going to do a lot of talking because I want to hear from you. I'm excited about having all of you on. And thank you. But I wanted to just throw some things out to kind of ground what we're going to talk about a little bit, and we can go from there. Because as I was listening and reading about what some of the media was writing and talking about, specifically with Fort Hood, the question seemed to be mostly about whether or not he was a terrorist, whether or not he was crazy, whether or not that kind of thing. And to me, that begs the opportunity that is there for us to talk about something different. And one of the questions I'd like for us to start with is when do we in our enthusiasm over our faith, when do we cross the line and start to violate other people's rights or other people's safety or other people's faith? When do we cross that line, and where is it? So if we could start with that, whoever wants to jump in first would be great.
I think it behooves us to say the obvious. First, I believe any rational person would proscribe physical violence as a problem. That clearly is a crossing of the line. I think all the major faith traditions would eschew the idea of physical violence. But I think that's only one step in the discussion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, and I agree with that, and I think we have to take one more step back, too, which is to say, again, the obvious that all of us on this call, I'm sure, mourn with the victims and their families.
Definitely. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that all of our traditions abhor this kind of violence and doesn't really come from that religious place.
Yes.
Yes, Deborah. I believe that one crosses the line first when one perhaps misinterprets text. I've seen here in the Middle East over and over again, and in many places in the world, not only here, where the Bible, the Quran, often are misinterpreted and unfortunately used as a tool. And I will confirm the idea of using a text, a sacred text, as a tool for power, money, and greed. And of course, violence is part of that combination. And secondly, one crosses the line, I think, when the spiritual becomes blurred in the emotion. And this is another thing, tempering one's emotion, understanding one's emotion. Actually, third, the crossing the line is misinterpreting gestures as coming from some spiritual force is crossing the line, and maybe we're misinterpreting what happened in Fort Hood as not having anything to do with anyone's even spiritual interpretation or interpretation of a text or a belief, and it's more of a personal problem.
And I think there's one more piece to that interpreting the text,
okay.
Which is that sometimes people are looking for easy answers. And unfortunately, for some of these topics, there aren't easy answers. And I represent a tradition that's 5,000 years old and talks about that there are 70 interpretations, correct interpretations, for each letter within Scripture.
Mm-hmm.
So that it then becomes a question of whose interpretation and what that interpretation is, and whether that's maybe this is too strong a word, a manipulation of an interpretation. And I get nervous, I think that's fair to say, when somebody says there's only one correct interpretation of a holy writing.
I would fully agree with that. I get very nervous about that too. And I would agree with both of you. What interests me is when you take the next step and look at some of the people, there are literally millions and millions of people who do believe that they have the right answer, who do think that there is only one way to interpret a text, and yet they would never resort to violence and wouldn't even think about it. And I'm wondering what the difference is or where the line is drawn between those folks who obviously have made a choice against violence and terrorism and others who seem to manage to become much more radicalized along the line of violence.
That's a great question, and that's one of the things that I want us to get to, along with all of the other things that were brought up as well. There are people who do believe that what they believe is the one true way. But like you said, they don't necessarily go out and try to force other people to do that, to believe what they believe. And what is that difference? And that's the line. That's one of the lines I want to talk about. And one of the things I think is that as solid as you are in your personal belief, that determines how well you are able to tolerate someone else's difference or even a challenge to your faith, you know?
That's a very good point.
Yeah, it's an excellent point, because I think that people who aren't secure in their knowledge or background feel sometimes threatened by the other.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a strand that runs through all of our traditions too.
That insecurity, if I could interject, often is exacerbated by lack of understanding of other spiritual ideas and the origins of those of other spirituality. And I find that's exacerbated here in the Middle East when I go across into Palestine and I'm I just got back from an interfaith peace march now, and I see often people, children, in fact, and Palestinian children, not just Palestinian children, I see also Jewish children that have been indoctrinated into a particular social belief. And it's a lot of it's based on hating another. I'm talking about the radical belief. Obviously, many that don't believe that way, based upon hate and basic misunderstanding. A Muslim, a Palestinian child will say many things about Jews and Christians, about their faith that they've learned from, leadership exploiting them, their leaders, for, I think the problem is money, power, and greed again. It's not about religion. And I think this, and it begets a certain amount of insecurity when you don't understand someone's philosophy, and then hate comes from misunderstanding, and then manipulation comes after that.
And then you've got a generational problem, too. I just finished writing a thesis on what happens in the third and fourth generations, and in some of these cases, it's been going on much longer than three and four generations, right?
Yeah.
So if you're looking at the whole question of reconciliation, which is a huge topic by itself, you can't really have reconciliation if people on either side of the equation don't feel safe.
I would agree with that. I would agree with that.
And so the question becomes, how do we as religious leaders educate about the other and create communities where people are safe? And we don't have time to do all that today, I'm sure. But this kind of thing helps in the long run. Which is why I was so keen to do it.
Mm-hmm. It does, yeah, and that's part of why I'm doing it as well, because I think a lot of times we switch back to our reptilian mind, where someone is presented and we're forced to we think, is this a friend? Should I fight? Should I run? Is this a mate possibility, or should I submit? And that's where a lot of us function, especially when we're talking about religion. And that doesn't leave a lot of room for communication because we don't feel safe, like you said.
And it takes, you know, I'm in the past president of the Greater Lowell Interfaith Leadership Alliance. It's an organization that I have been involved with for 20-some-odd years. There are still thorny issues, and some of these people I have been working with for all of those 20-some-odd years. But some of the best moments of my life have come out of that group as well. So, for instance, on 9/11, I was in New York City at rabbinical school, and it was a very scary time for everybody. I don't want to minimize that. On 9/12, because we had scheduled it in advance, the clergy of Greater Lowell were working on a Habitat for Humanity house. So while the world seemed to be crumbling around us, we were actually building something of lasting importance. I'm not sure there was any more powerful day in my life than that one. So those bridges can be built, but they can take years to do it.
That was almost prophetic. Excuse me, just to interject, that was almost prophetic. The day after 9/11, your focus is on something so appropriate.
It was
and a possible remedy. Excellent. Wow.
But because we had already had the process in place, because that group of clergy felt safe enough already to do that and to role model it.
I think this is interesting to talk about religion as a possible barrier or a bone of contention, because I always find it ironic that the practices, the spiritual practices that so many of our religions have used for so many millennia, are the very things that can actually soften our hearts toward one another. I think as we encounter the divine, however we define that, through prayer, through the reading of text, through community where we encounter diverse perspectives inside and outside of our faith traditions. Those things should be able to open us up so that we can approach the other person with a clear mind and an open heart. And yet, ironically, we spend so much time fighting about religion rather than letting it transform us.
I might add
too that softening of the heart, that is so wonderfully said. I haven't heard that articulated in such a succinct and appropriate way, that softening the heart can also be then used to manipulate them too, doesn't it? It makes us exposed. So it's ironic, isn't it? What you started out with, softening the heart to make us have compassion, understand, and love each other, can also be used sometimes. And this then exacerbates world conflict and community conflict.
Exactly.
I'm sorry, I think someone was saying something.
I had dinner with my brother last night, and we had the same parents, obviously, and the same basic upbringing. He sees the world very differently than I do. He sees religion as something that throughout the years has been used to tear people apart, and I see religion as a way that can bring people together. But we talked about what I might say today as a piece of this. Oh, you agree with me. Because I'm not sure we would be having this discussion at all today if the media hadn't portrayed the alleged perpetrator as a Muslim, right? You know, if it had just been, I'm not even sure what the language should be, but if it had just been somebody who had, you know, if it had just been a psychiatrist who was working at Fort Hood and the religion piece wasn't stated at all,
mm-hmm.
we wouldn't be having this discussion. So one of my concerns in this is the fact that of how the media has inflamed this.
I would agree with that, and I think one of the problems that we have is, I think it's time to take a fresh look at our definition of the word terrorism itself.
Mm.
I think in far too many people's minds, the phrase Islamic terrorism is redundant, and clearly that's not the case. I was doing a little thinking about what ties together the terrorism of the last 20, 30 years, and I think you can point to physical violence. I think you can point to the fact that it's designed to create a media splash. It's designed to intimidate. It's designed to unnerve. But in no way does it all come from one particular faith perspective or even any faith perspective.
Mm.
Look back at the Oklahoma City bombing.
We were thinking about that last night, too.
Exactly. I mean, I think that certainly qualifies as an act of terrorism, but it did not come from a specific religious background or faith tradition.
But it also did come from a sense of fundamentalism, from what I can gather from that one.
Mm.
So what is it about fundamentalism that causes, or maybe doesn't cause, that kind of violence?
I think we need to get into distinctions at this point of definitions, because fundamentalism, radicalism, extremism, orthodox, and things often are mixed around in the news and shouldn't be, before we even get off on this discussion. And secondly, you know, Deborah, and I'm sorry, I'm bad at names, Deborah and Bud,
John and Margaret.
John and Margaret, John and Margaret. This type of discussion is exactly what I think is what's needed, and I thank you for setting this up, and probably more of these discussions were needed to temper this news frenzy that tends to ignite and trigger so much almost violent emotion that gives rise to hate and gives rise, which is back into that misunderstanding, hate, ignorance, whirlpool that we were talking about before.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yes, and I think the fundamentalism part is, I think, linked strongly with unquestioning belief.
Mm-hmm.
Unquestioning. You don't question it. You don't
explore
it. You don't make it yours. in other words, because when I think of someone asking questions, they're trying to make information theirs. They're trying to understand it so it becomes part of their worldview. The way I see fundamentalism is, that whole questioning process is usurped.
Let's correct me if I'm wrong. If we can just get our definitions out, so I understand. I'm not sure if I understand distinctions. And that is unquestioning, and fundamentalism then would be considered as the text or whatever, however the interpretation is. Without question, this is it. Orthodox then meaning the pretty much, not necessarily in a derogatory, Orthodox Jew, Orthodox Christian, Orthodox Muslim, be someone who believes in the approach that's pretty well acceptable. Not necessarily, and we hear Orthodox thrown around as being also unwavering and inflexible, not necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get to the word extremism,
mm-hmm.
militantism, where extremism is the way you raise the bar, the extent that you are capable of using the text even to a fanatic degree, and then they have fanaticism, meaning that you can literally take it to a violent level. You become such a violent and passionate believer that you're willing to go a step further and interpret your beliefs into violence and irrational reaction based upon that I would call unfounded passion. But correct me if I'm wrong. Have we got our definitions right? I'm sure there's something to add to them so that you make sure we know what we're talking about.
The one thing I would add,
yes.
I want to be very careful about how we define fundamentalism.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Because it can mean 10 different things to 8 different people, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I know some people whom some of my more progressive friends would call fundamentalist without question. And yet, mm-hmm. I know those people to be very thoughtful, to question. They do question within a certain prescribed boundary. I mean, there are certain places where they don't go.
Mm-hmm.
But they do raise a lot of questions within their own understanding of their faith. And that, I think, is another thing that makes this such a difficult nut to crack in some ways, because, mm-hmm. as I said before, we have a lot, I think there are a lot of conservative believers who believe in the text, word for word, divinely inspired, who would never commit violence. Who would never go? And I think in that case, Frank's definition or distinction between fundamentalism and extremism is very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah, and I think we need to underscore that there are plenty of people who would never resort to violence.
Mm-hmm.
And,
absolutely.
And that does seem to be the separating line here.
I can see that emphasized in the West Bank. And I know I must catch myself too in placing people in these rigid categories, as you both have helped me get out of, by keeping an open mind. When they say, for instance, many of the Jews that are involved in the settlements, they say, well, they're Orthodox Jews, and in reality, many of them believe that they have a Torah obligation to be here. And then instead of just classifying them as saying they're all Orthodox, that's really not as accepted by most Jews in the world. What they're doing is they believe that this is all part of ex-Israel and to be in their obligation and duty to settle this area. And I find here that terms are thrown around a lot. And as soon as these terms are thrown around, it becomes derogatory, and then emotions come into play, and our bets are off for any discussion then. And then it's always out there like this, they're hateful, and then it leads to heated disputes, and then right here, very quickly, can lead to violence.
Yep.
Yep.
I agree. Speaking of the divine, or the sense of divine inspiration or divine calling, in preparation for this segment today, I was reading a little bit of biographical information about Osama bin Laden, and as I read it, I kept looking for mental imbalance or mental illness. I kept looking for the snidely whiplash, stereotypical evil fellow, and I didn't really that. I did find somebody who was, who believed that his brand of faith requires him to do what he is doing. Now, that does not stop me from calling his acts uncategorically evil. But I'm fascinated by the fact that it does seem to be he has a sense of religious calling toward the violence that he's perpetrating.
You know, what you're saying is clear here in many ways, is that understanding is so important for us, just like understanding what happened at Fort Hood. And again, this discussion hopefully will lead to that,
yeah.
To temper what's happening in the press and the emotions among people, so we really can understand what happened and understand that people like Osama bin Laden, I'm obviously not Caroline, the psychiatrist, and Osama bin Laden, not, and I think what we're saying is we're not justifying what they're doing, but are able to understand. And I think I can take this to a different level, not a higher level. Here in Israel and Palestine, I'm finding most Israelis I've met clearly want peace, and clearly spiritual people, and are working in their own ways for peace. But I believe there's a strong element here, and this may exacerbate a certain amount of discussion here, in the Israeli government, that I believe it's still suffering from the Holocaust, and I think they need a certain amount of treatment and so forth, because how often have we been mistreated and we turn around and mistreat others? And there's a certain grain of that here, where mistreating and then interpreting text to justify what they're doing in the West Bank and in Gaza and so forth. People need to know these are not all Israelis, but these are some people that need a certain amount of understanding and maybe even treatment, because turning around and seeking revenge, and sometimes I can see the Palestinians are victim of some type of revenge that is being met out by those who have suffered. If we can get back to, I understand now, even though it's not justified, some of these violent acts I see perpetrated by the state of Israel, and obviously a lot of acts perpetrated by fanatic Muslims, are not justified, but on the psychological level, we get into the psyche of these people, as you've done with bin Laden, we can understand. I think this is the first beginning of understanding, is a beginning of then going further and understanding what's happening in the world, as opposed to taking knee-jerk approaches that create, again, problems and exacerbate more emotion and ignorance and then hate and then desire to invade, desire to take military action, or desire for violence to resolve the problem.
There was a fascinating article or interview, I think, on CNN several years ago when Israel invaded Lebanon. And there was a Lebanese father of a three-month-old who said that he had never had an issue with Israel before and still didn't really have an issue, but that now that his home had been bombed, and he was holding this three-month-old who survived. I mean, there was no injury involved.
Mm-hmm.
That he knew that the peace process had been set back 20 years, which is, in fact, a generation.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I think, you talked about the Holocaust, and we're 60 years removed from that and 60 years removed from the founding of the State of Israel. It is a safety question. And it just keeps going on and on and on. But I think there's another way to go in this conversation as well.
Yes.
Which is that when you have somebody in a leadership position that winds up with that kind of fear and lack of safety and then uses religious language to justify what they're doing politically, I think that can be dangerous as well. And I think we've seen the U.S. government do that several times since 9/11.
Yes.
And I wasn't sure that I wanted to talk about that in this forum, but it concerned me, and I don't have access to the same information that Carl Levin does, when Senator Levin spoke this weekend about what happened at Fort Hood.
In branding it as an act of terrorism?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that there will be yet more to come out linking the alleged perpetrator, because I do believe in guilty until proven, innocent until proven guilty, and there hasn't been a trial or a court-martial yet.
That's true.
But that there will be a larger email trail linking this guy to an extremist, I think his language was an extremist fundamentalist Islamic leader. And that scares me, because I don't know what he's looking at, and I think that inflames the rhetoric. So
yeah.
While this is not about Republican and Democrat, because we've seen it happen in both parties now, but I think that political leaders also have to be very careful of their language.
I have been struck as I have looked, as I've prepared myself for this segment in reading about Major Hassan, how little we really know about him. The reports that we do have seem to contradict one another. He is a Muslim who he is a pious Muslim, or he is mentally disturbed. He has become a radical or not. There are so many different cross currents, even in the factual reporting, that it seems just really premature for anyone to label this either terrorism or label it anything at this point. I would agree.
And I think we all have a responsibility. And talking about responsibility, I think we all seem to be floating toward that same, or at least one principle, is if anything comes out now, which things are coming out now, and as you say, we must take a step back. We may not have, probably don't have the same information. On the other hand, who's interpreting the information? And I think you're right. This is premature to start concluding. We'll find out more. And all this, or is this just one man trying to use the press now to get some attention for his own? Unfortunately, it's not to be too cynical about it, for his own political gain. And then when the truth comes out and the trial is over, we find that clearly was an exaggeration. But it's an opportune time now to get the focus of Fox News and all this and get your name out by spewing forth these irresponsible things that you're saying about someone that you really haven't found out about. Like you say, we must ask us, do we really know about this person, what information we have about this person, before concluding that there's any terrorist link.
And the power of language can be so subtle. I read the NPR report that came out, the actual document on Major Hassan, that said, and actually there were some pieces of it, that were troubling and strange to me. Like, one of the things against him was he apparently had his body fat percentage out of whack. Okay? That's not a psych issue.
No.
But that was in this report. Okay? I didn't know what to make of that. So I shared the document with a woman in the Boston area whose specialty is in post-traumatic stress, because that's been discussed a lot in the media as well. And I said, okay, you're a therapist. This is your area of expertise. This is the report that his superiors wrote on him. What do you see in this that may be troubling professionally? Because that's not my expertise.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? I said, it's a little concerning that they used the language that he shared his religious beliefs. But frankly, she has shared her religious beliefs with me. She's a Jewish Quaker, which is sort of an interesting combination all by itself. And her specialty is in PTSD. So she was a natural resource for me on this. And she said, sharing the religious beliefs is permissible, but the fact that it shows up in this report suggests that possibly he was proselytizing, which was the way it got reported in the news. Right, she used the term very specifically, because otherwise, usually this kind of thing, when you're doing one-on-one counseling, would not rise up unless somebody had complained. So that's a whole different perspective on this thing that I wouldn't have necessarily as a religious leader.
I don't understand. I just don't understand the proselytizing. Who's proselytizing?
The document said that one of the things that concerned his supervisors was that he shared his religious beliefs.
The document
did not say that he had proselytized. The news media said he had proselytized. The therapist says, sharing religious beliefs by itself is not a problem in a therapeutic situation. But for it to show up in this kind of document suggests to her that somebody complained about it. Because otherwise, since you do counseling one-on-one, they wouldn't know.
Something they would know.
So that's a really subtle use of language.
And I think part of our issue is that our infrastructure tends to push us toward a rush to judgment. The 24-hour news cycle, I mean, if you hear the word, in that case, it's so easy from one news cycle to the next to have somebody change the copy so that it starts reading proselytizing.
Mm-hmm.
And then before you know it, the word proselytizing is used everywhere, and the distortion has already happened. I think that the fact that society moves so fast, the fact that the news media moves so fast, makes it difficult once those things start to try to correct them.
Yeah, and the bloggers as well. People put stuff out on blogs.
Absolutely.
And it becomes a news story.
Mm-hmm.
And then so many people seem to be dependent then on these news. It's almost like a news drug. And almost their emotions change with the tide of news that is often manipulated. Very quickly, I guess this is a new generation that we're aware of this and aware that we need to take a step back. This should be part of our education now, take a step back and access other news sources. Maybe this could temper the possibility of starting using terms, all of a sudden coining terms that someone coined as becoming almost a standard overnight.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of other news sources, I always encourage people to, one, know more than one language and read about your country in the language that you're learning, because you'll get a very different perspective often. Very different.
Even listening to Canadian news or the BBC gives you a very different perspective on world news than we get in the United States, if you don't have a foreign language that you can draw on.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I think even within the borders of the United States, if people can simply absorb media that they don't necessarily agree with, for instance, if I'm a labor union leader, it would behoove me to read The Economist, which has a very free market bias, so that I can understand what they're saying from their perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I think when you do that, too, it has a moderating influence. You start to look at other people and you see, their perspectives are quite reasonable, actually. Even the perspectives I might have vilified in a former life, I find reasonable, and I can see how reasonable people could hold those. And I think it makes one more open to dialogue with people like that.
So here's a question I want to throw out. Let's take that, what we just said with the media, and apply that to other people's faith traditions. Now, we have interfaith different services and things like that, which is great, wonderful. But they tend to be politically correct.
Hmm.
And I'll give an example of myself. I was brought up Catholic in the Catholic tradition. I'm not Catholic now, but that's my background. And one of the things that opened my eyes was having service for a really strong Pentecostal tradition and joining their prayer group and being part of that, and then leading them in worship, right? That was totally foreign to me, where people were speaking in tongues and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But now I'm a different minister, one, and I understand where before it was just something that was totally off to me, and I just couldn't quite connect to it in any way at all. So how do we do that? And as religious leaders, how do we encourage people to go into that experiment and go into that experience?
I think there are a number of ways to do it, and some of it can be those kinds of interfaith services which tend to be politically correct, and sometimes they're not always politically correct, and sometimes we get them flat out wrong. The service the year after 9/11 in Lowell was not so politically correct, where we actually had the bishop, the local Catholic bishop, stand there. I was late because as the Jew, I get to go to all of these, so I was double booked. And I walked in late to my home service and shook the bishop's hand on the way in and caught the rabbi on the way out. Apparently he stood there and said that he knew that at the moment of impact that everybody in the World Trade Center had embraced Jesus as their Lord and Savior and that they were fine.
Mm. Oh, dear.
Okay. So sometimes we don't always get it right. But, you know, one of the things that I'm doing these days is as part of that group, there's now a book discussion group. There are a couple of books that I could recommend that would be really interesting. The current one we're reading is called The Faith Club, which is three women's perspectives, a Muslim, a Jew, and a Christian.
Mm.
Not quite broad enough for Greater Lowell, by the way, because we have more Buddhists these days and Hindus in Lowell than any other faith tradition.
Mm-hmm.
But it gives you a lay person's perspective, not a scholarly work, on what they think about scripture and prayer and death and, you know, just baseline topics that concern us all in an easily read thing. The other book that I think is really an interesting one for groups like this to discuss, there's a gentleman, Bruce Feiler, who wrote a series of books about the Bible. He did one looking at Abraham, just Abraham stories from the three faith traditions, all of whom embrace Abraham.
Mm-hmm.
And there are, in fact, differences in how he's embraced.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of Abraham, today we engage in the interfaith march where Abraham and Sarah, Isaac, are buried in Hebron. And this, you know, this is a place. This is sort of interject a little something else in this discussion that hopefully linked. This should be the most understanding, harmonious, beautiful area in all of the Middle East, because Abraham, being the father of Judaism, is one in Christianity, one of the fathers, main fathers. And yet, it's a terrible war zone, and exacerbated by both sides, and so forth and so on. But to help understand what has happened here, and understand how we've somehow been polarized, not just on a religious level, I think it's important to get to use a sort of an interfaith approach, not a syncretic approach where everything's blurred into one and so forth, but to understand different approaches and different faiths, so that in the future, when it's time for dialogue, we can see the similarities as opposed to focusing on the differences. I think this is one solution for peace, is as opposed to looking at common denominators among the main religions. And I didn't want to bring this up, but the Storm Over Morocco, the one that I wrote, it was just in line with this discussion, is what helped me temper the brainwashing that I was receiving from this extremist group, was my knowledge of different religions that seemed to complement each other, which led me to conclude that not one religion seems to have all the pieces of the puzzle. And yet putting them together, again, not in a syncretic, blurring them, but looking at each individual religion and how they overlap with others and the main principles being very similar, it gives me a much better understanding and a stronger understanding of who I was, helping resist extremisms and possible knee-jerk reactions to things, because I had a certain understanding of those religions. So that was a practical way. The interfaith helped me survive a difficult situation, which can be applied to everyday life.
my phone cut out briefly, so I made everything that you said. But I think I've had a similar experience, except coming at it from a slightly different angle. In my lighter moments, I like to refer to myself as a recovering fundamentalist. I did spend a little bit of my youth in some very conservative churches, and you know, come out of that for a while, or come out of that permanently, I believe. But one of the things that started to convince me that that I didn't have the whole story was that I started to read about different faith traditions and thought, my goodness, for one thing, these are beautiful. There are some fabulous things that they believe, and they do reflect the way the world works. And they're even answering different questions than my faith tradition answers. Mm-hmm. And the more I did that, the more I saw those differences and how valid they looked, the more I realized that I did not have all the answers either. And that's one of the many things that really pried me away from fundamentalism in the long run.
And I think that recognizing that however we interpret spirituality or God or the divine, that it's bigger than us and we don't have all the answers,
yes,
is the start to this kind of healing.
Mm-hmm. We don't know what God wants or knows. Because I tell people that all the time. If you say, I know what God wants, you're putting yourself above God.
Yeah.
And we all chuckle as you say that, because we've gotten to the place where we agree with you, but sometimes people want those easy answers.
I know.
Oh, yeah.
I know.
I was on a hike with a woman who calls herself the Adventure Rabbi, and she's fascinating because the whole concept that you can do spirituality outside of the synagogue walls and do them outdoors in nature where, you know, maybe God created the world is a wonderful concept, I think. But her mini sermon on the hike was a book that I've read over and over again called When Bad Things Happen to Good People.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's really important that she makes the point that the title is not why bad things happen to good people,
mm-hmm.
it's when bad things happen. Because in everybody's life, something bad will happen at some point. The question is, how do we respond to it?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where we really are with Fort Hood.
Yes.
One of the things that I think is beautiful in the Jewish tradition and in the Islamic tradition is we share something in common. In the Midrash, it says, somebody who saves a single life is as though they've saved the whole world. That same phrase is in the Quran.
Mm.
Yes.
So that one of the things that we should look at in the response to Fort Hood and to other similar kinds of tragedies is that there were real heroes who stepped forward that day and saved lives.
Yes.
It seemed like then this psychiatrist in Fort Hood then was maybe on a slippery slope, emotion. I think he spent there in solitude and brought in suffering in his own personal life. Somehow, if he could have read some of these books or been in touch with some of these sort of interfaith approaches through meetings or through text or through internet, might have tempered this slippery slope when it snapped. And what you're all talking about then, focusing on it, exactly what interfaith is about. Well, by golly, you've just cited something in the Torah, the Pentateuch, which is clearly mentioned and supported in the Quran as well as the New Testament. And you can even see it mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita that, and then people go, oh yeah, I didn't. And they've been hating Muslims so much and saying that the Quran is just a violent document without having read it, of course, often just reading commentaries. And this will help us a great deal for healing. And as we were chuckling, and I'm glad you brought that up, I think I was chuckling because sometimes I can get into that slippery slope myself and believe I'm actually interpreting God.
Right.
And Unfortunately, I was through books and through understanding through prayer. It's not that I'm stopping myself. I said, let myself go. I understand that I'm getting into a comfort zone, a very dangerous comfort zone, where I become one and all, and I'm listening to what God is telling me, and now I know what God wants. Then I'm in a danger zone, but fortunately, I've been able to read these texts and have these discussions like we're having today and listen to them and feel them. It helped me understand what's going on, which tempers this strange tendency that I think we have as human beings to want to get into this ideological comfort zone. So, like you said, a facile comfort zone. Which, you know.
I think that one of the things that people want to is that they want to feel like they're in control.
Yes.
And I keep learning that I'm not.
Yes.
I might like to be, but I'm not. One of the things that I think scares me about Fort Hood and the media's race to judgment is that I'm not sure we will ever fully understand all the pieces that contributed to the tragedy. I think it's clearly too easy to say that he's an Islamic fundamentalist, right? It's too easy to say that this was an act of terrorism, but people will continue down that path for a while to come. And it's too easy to just say he snapped because he listened to too many other people's stories of trauma.
Mm. Yes.
All of those are too easy.
Yeah. Yes.
And I don't know what to do with that other than to just keep repeating that so that maybe we don't get caught in that trap.
I think one of the really frightening things about admitting that is that there's so much emphasis in the media, and justifiably so, on what can we learn from this so that we can prevent it from happening again. And the frightening thing about not being able to get to the bottom of any of these is that we may have to admit to ourselves that, well, we can't always prevent it from happening again. Things happen, and sometimes they are just beyond our capacity to understand them.
We just had
you both coined the word frightening, and I guess I've got a different reaction to it because I was a direct victim of extremism, or I was actually imprisoned by an extremist group. And when I read that, I didn't feel frightened because I think I have a defense mechanism that is set in. I think I've been immunized from feeling fright first because I lived through it. On the other hand, I think this is just the comfort maybe in myself. It's a terrible gray area. And I think this can, of course, lead to fright. And I think maybe it has something to do with me working here in Israel and in the West Bank with all people from all religions, in particular Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, and working with extremists, including radicals. I've had meetings with members of the head of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, for instance, in Jenin, where I was yesterday at a peace march. I didn't interview him yesterday, and he's still being, apparently, the state of Israel is still looking for him to get his approach. But I think I'm understanding this right away. How, and you're right, we can't knee-jerk, you can't just say he snapped because of, he had terrorist tendencies because he's a fanatic Muslim. You're right. On the other hand, if we can get away also with even feeling, the fear is obviously through insecurity and lack of knowledge that these extremists actually were simply indoctrinated, they were indoctrinated so young. And then follow the path. And then the question is, and I have no easy answers, how can we temper this tendency in some groups to do so? And when it ends up in these violent reactions, how can we work toward world peace? This is a fundamental element toward world peace, if we can find some way to temper that. There will always be some extremism, but more and more temper that tendency.
There are signs of hope, and I applaud what you're doing. There's an organization that I work with tangentially in the States called Kulanu that works with a population in Uganda. And what they have done in Uganda is they've set up a collaborative of coffee growers. And these coffee growers are Jewish, Muslim, and Christian coffee growers that are selling their beans to the United States, all fair trade, all certified kosher. And I won't be able to pronounce the African for it, but it translates as delicious peace, P-E-A-C-E. And if we can do more of that kind of thing, if we can do more microfinancing, if we can do more building of schools so that people are educated, I think that, at least for me, hope springs eternal.
And thank you for that suggestion. I mean, and thank you for that compliment. But, you know, what you're focusing on is even the next step that I haven't even been able to reach yet. So they're even beyond that. And you're absolutely right, and at least the way I feel, that once all the talking aside, and I'm still at the dialogue stage, mobilizing people and getting us to understand each other, is to bond, is what these people are doing. How do you bond? It's through projects. And then
sometimes
you sweat together.
It's easier to do the projects than to debate the hard theological issues.
Well, maybe.
Build
the
habitat house to
yeah.
plant the olive tree on the West Bank.
There is nothing like face-to-face time with people that are different than you to soften your heart to them, I think.
Yes.
I think that's a good metaphor, the softening of the heart.
Softening the heart, not on just the dialogue stage. That's interesting you bring that up. The working together might be that, well, understanding things subliminally by work, by feeling the other person's presence as opposed to verbalizing. But I think that is actually a goal. And of course, the verbalizing may come or not, but if we can work together and feel, and it does help to soften the heart, but not only that, it builds strong bonds, which is what's needed more than anything.
Yeah. This has been great. So, any last thoughts before we leave?
I think this, if we could somehow, this discussion, it was succinct, and Debra, thank you, and thank you, the other invited guests, is if you can get this out, I think this would be a very important part to of the information process. I think it's what's needed all over the world, not just in the United States. And I thank you. And your questions were your selection of people to engage in this discussion is just fantastic. And your questions were great. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
I hope it could lead to something. Yeah. Thank
it's
you.
A very rich discussion.
I would just say that I think the more we do these things as individuals, the more of a counterweight we provide to the extremism and the shouting and the contention that's out there. And, you know, I mean, it's our way to build a better world.
Mm-hmm.
I agree.
I wish you all success in your work, and we will be in touch again. And thank you.
Thank you, Debra.
Thank you.
Debra.
All right. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Thank you.
That's all I have today. This is All the Way In, special edition. Until next time. Today, thanks for listening, and remember to live all the way in your life. Until next time, stay connected. Visit DebraELake.com, and while you're there, sign up to follow on Twitter and Facebook. You'll also be able to download previously recorded programs. And sign up to become a member and get your edition of the brand new All the Way In newsletter. Members also have access to follow-up broadcasts and special discounts. Remember that you can take All the Way In wherever you go through iTunes. If you have any questions or comments, send an email to allthewayin
at DeborahELake.com. I'd love to hear from you. All the Way In is a production of Lake Enterprise.